we're talking about domestic abuse, not just the physical, but the emotional abuse from an intimate partner and how to break the cycle and bring healing. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The pandemic has made things worse. Incidents of domestic violence have increased the exposure of women to abusive partners and limited access to services. And that is from the World Health Organization earlier this year. Have you experienced domestic violence? What can you share about your life and what is happening now? It's 800-642-1234. Daryl Hanusa has been treating perpetrators of domestic violence for more than 40 years. He practices at the Midwest Center for Human Services and is a senior lecturer at UW-Madison School of Social Work. Daryl, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thanks for having me this morning.
Well, from your vantage point, are you seeing more domestic abuse in the pandemic?
Well, I am. In fact, across the board, I'm just seeing a general increase in depression and anxiety, isolation and lack of connection. And certainly in situations where there's intimate partner violence, it would even make that worse simply because we know that when isolation is a major feature of most domestic violence situations in the first place. And then if we have to quarantine and we can't, we lose our connections to our social group and functional systems, meaning support systems, that really also increases the likelihood that violence can occur and go undetected. Because if you're a victim, you really can't leave. There's no place to go and no place where you can go to be safe because of quarantining. The other part of it is we know that economic hardship can really increase the intensity of domestic violence and frequency. And so as people have lost their jobs and stress has increased because of that, we see definitely an increase in domestic violence. I probably am averaging somewhere around 3 to 4 new referrals every week of domestic violence related cases.
You're bringing in so many contributing factors here, not just the mental health challenges in the pandemic, but economic challenges and the isolation piece. Can you explain for us what qualifies as abuse? What do you consider abuse?
Right. So the behavioral definition of abuse, and I'll give you the broad definition, it is a pattern of coercive behavior aimed at that person's partner that causes them pain. So it would include emotional abuse, psychological abuse, kind of use our terms used interchangeably. So name calling, put down, sarcastic comments, swearing, screaming, getting in someone's face to intimidate them, threatening to leave, threatening to have an affair, keeping that partner from having access to joint property, preventing her from leaving, telling her that they're and I'm saying her because most of the people that I work with are men, but women, are abusive as well. But I'll keep using male pronouns until someone wants me to change that. But preventing her from having contact with family, a lot of jealousy that he'll tell her, you care more for your family and your friends than you care for me. I don't want you to see them. Financial control where he's not giving her money or preventing her from having money, stealing her money, all the way to physical abuse, which includes things like grabbing, pushing, shoving, slapping, punching, kicking, strangulation. Rape should be included as a huge issue. There's verbal pressure to have sex, and there's actual physical force to have sex. So the use of weapons, threats of weapons. So it runs on a continuum in the broadest definition of the term.
You are referring to men here. Are most abusers men? What does the research tell you?
Well, the research is has to be viewed very, very carefully, because what the research says is that 1 in 3 women and 1 in 7 men experience domestic violence in their lifetime. But the research, if you look at it just from that basis without going underneath and finding out what it really means, you will be misinformed. First of all, there's an underreporting in terms of domestic violence across the board. Fact of the matter is women underreport more than men. And that's counterintuitive. Most people would say, well, men aren't going to report because they don't want to look foolish. They're embarrassed. They're not a real man if they report violence. Fact of the matter is some really important studies that have been done, one from Canada and one in the United States, show that men are more apt to report than their women counterparts, particularly if it involves things like getting child custody. So women underreport more than men do in some regards. The other thing is that when you look at the data for men, 1 in 7, that doesn't include female-to-male violence exclusively. It includes male-to-male violence, like a son to a father. Hmm. Or those kinds of statistics, because that's included in the definition of domestic. It can be two adults in an intimate relationship. It can be family members, brother, sister, brother, 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 father, brother, you know, those kind of dynamics as well. So the numbers are a little bit inflated, I think, for men, and probably a little underreported. I really think that the statistic for women is that one in two women will be or has been abused in their intimate relationship in a lifetime.
Wow, that's really severe. Darryl Hanusa is with us, a clinical social worker in Madison, where he's been providing domestic abuse counseling and treatment services for decades. Have you experienced domestic abuse? How did you deal with the situation? Were you able to get help? Where are you today? Join in, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Darryl, where does this stem from? Like, can you back up for us and explain why men abuse their partners and what this might be coming from?
Well, you know, it really is a complex matrix of factors that play into someone making the choice to use violence in the relationship. I mean, years ago, we're probably right now on our fourth generation of battery intervention programs. And when we first started, we basically had a simple answer, and that is it's about power and control. And we accepted that, and people accepted that. However, and that's really comes from a sociological perspective, that it's about gender disequality and inequality. And even though we know that was the case, those of us that had mental health training like myself, we knew that there was more to the story. But the Battered Women's Movement, back when we first started, I mean, I started doing this work back in the late 70s, they didn't want us to start programs for men who batter because they didn't want to pathologize abusers. They wanted it to be a social issue that was dealt with in social action. So we did some of that in all of our programs. We did that, but also we knew that it's a little bit more difficult than that. So what we see is that for many men, they have their own histories of abuse, being trauma victims of abuse, I should say. They learn by watching their parents deal with their own conflicts. Oftentimes there wasn't any constructive learning. They saw mom and dad fight it out or use the silent treatment. And so they're left with sort of a question mark. Well, how do you handle conflict in an intimate relationship? They do have some issues like depression. We know that depression can be a factor because people who are depressed have heightened irritability. They have issues with impulsivity at times. They really have a hard time understanding, other than walking it out or punching it out metaphorically, how to handle conflict. So they really have what's called a social skills deficit when it comes to conflict resolution. So when you add all those factors together, from a treatment perspective, we have to ask, well, what can we do to help these men be in a situation where conflict is inevitable, but they make the choice to handle that conflict in a constructive way? And so that's kind of how we've built programs, certainly our program here, the ADAM program in Madison, but nationally, best practices really have looked at, you know, what are the reasons why men batter and how can we change that?
Yeah, we're going to look at that program a little more specifically here. But I want to ask you, you know, your center also works with teens on abusive relationships. Is there an age when men typically start to exhibit abusive behavior, or can you, back up this intervention earlier?
Well, I wish we had the resources to really do that. For years, I taught a program called Teens and Tempers in the school system. So I was training the trainers. So I would go in and work with school personnel, social workers and psychologists, to work with kids and teach them social skills, conflict resolution, and gender equality attitudes and beliefs. Unfortunately, you know, when budgets get tough, those are the kinds of programs that go by the wayside much more quickly. So I don't know if there's a particular age, but what I certainly see children who witness abuse use those tactics and use them earlier than children who aren't in that experience. So I think, you know, certainly teenagers, it's a great time to intervene even before that if you can. But it really is about attitudes and having the technology and behaviors to know what to do differently. I cannot tell you how often I've worked with men in the ADAM program who have said to me as they're going through treatment, this is wonderful. Why wasn't somebody teaching me this in high school or middle school even before that?
We're talking with clinical social worker Daryl Tanusa, explaining the major problems of intimate partner violence, how to intervene, provide care, and please take care in this conversation. Have you been an abuser? Did you undergo treatment for your behavior? What insight did you gain about what caused your behavior? Join in, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Daryl Tanusa here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we look at domestic violence and what professional help can do to find true healing and recovery. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The UN, the United Nations, is referring to the increase in domestic violence as a shadow pandemic. Emerging data, the UN says, points to an increase in calls to domestic violence helplines, not just here in the U.S., but across the world. Do you know someone in an abusive relationship? What questions do you have for a clinical social worker? How can we be more responsive, more respectful towards survivors of interpersonal violence? 800-642-1234. Daryl Tanusa is with us from the Midwest Center for Human Services, with us for the hour. Daryl, we heard from Jean, called in from Barneveld and couldn't stay with us. Jean says that they were in an abusive marriage for 15 years, and it took Jean that long to get out of it. And Jean asks, why does it take so long for women or men in abusive relationships to get out?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, none of us go in a relationship with the idea that we're going to end it someday. We believe that the vows that we make, that for better or worse, that keep us in that relationship. So we want to make it work. A lot of people who are in relationships come from situations where they didn't have a family, and so family is really important. So they'll do everything they can to try to keep the family together. Abusers contributed to women's inability to leave as well, because they say to her, it's your fault, and no one's going to have you. You can't get along with anybody. Look at you, even fight with your family. Oftentimes women are financially in a situation where maybe it's a dual income family, but trying to make a go of it by yourselves is really hard. Custody is a huge factor for women that keeps them there, because you'll say, go ahead and leave me, but I'll get custody of the kids. Mm. Or even if they share custody, it means that if he's abusive to her, that there's a potential that he could be abusive to the kids. And as long as she's there to monitor that, she can help keep them safe. But if in a situation, particularly in Dane County, oftentimes there's a joint placement where he has them half time or a portion of the time where she's not even there. Now her worry factor goes up, because now she can't run interference if he gets angry with the kids. So many factors, the fear factor, where does she go? What does she do? Does she have adequate job skills to support herself and her children? So many factors keep women there.
You've been mentioning the program called the Alternatives and Treatment for Abusive Men that is run through your Midwest Domestic Violence Resource Center. Can you explain the approach to this program?
Yes, it's a multidimensional, integrated cognitive behavioral psychotherapy, psychodynamic kind of program with a pro-feminist analysis. How is that for a description? Let me break that down a little bit. There are three phases to the group. After a very detailed assessment evaluation, then the men come into the program. They go through an orientation session, which really sets them up for the program, where they have to break down what they've done. They have to talk about their abuse among the men that are there, which is really a cathartic kind of thing, because these men don't go around telling people what they've done. Of course, they want to hide that. underneath it all, they're very ashamed of their behavior and know that what they're doing is not okay, but they don't want to talk about it. And who do you tell? You don't go to a nightclub or a bar with your friend and say, oh, guess what? I punched my partner out last night. So it's a way for them in a safe place where no one's going to judge them to start talking about the abuse in their relationship. They learn definitions like what's the difference between anger and abuse, for instance, and we break that down. After that orientation group is over, that's brief, that's 4 sessions, then they start a very, very comprehensive, very structured skills group phase where we teach them tools. We give them conflict resolution tools. They have to practice and learn techniques. We teach them relaxation methodologies to decrease their intensity at those critical moments where they typically escalate. We work on their distortions and thoughts that really set them up to escalate and help them de-escalate those thoughts. And we look at issues of male power control, entitlement, and privilege, which are some of the factors that really are the underpinnings of why they choose abuse in the first place. So that's a 20-session phase once a week for 2.5 hours. After that's over, we have an exit interview with them. We give them a verbal report card. We check with their partners to kind of get an update on how they think it's going. And then they enter into the last phase of the program, which is called a process self-help group. And that answers the question why. The skills group answers the question what and how. What do I do with conflict and how do I do it? So it's really hands-on kind of work. The process self-help group answers the question why. Why am I so abusive with the very people that I say I care the most about? So we get at family of origin issues. And one of the factors that is really unique now to our program, and a lot of programs around the country are looking at this area as best practice, we look at each man's trauma. Because years ago, I stumbled across an idea that really has proven fruitful, and that is I had an abusive man share his story of the abuse that he experienced as a child. And when I took him through a form called the Woman Abuse Scale, he said yes to everything. He had done everything on that list of 26 items to his partner. And then he looked at me and he said, you know, I told him I was really surprised, and he said, I don't know why you're surprised. That's the way men are supposed to treat women. Mm-hmm. And it really, I was floored by that, because I thought people understand what abuse is, but a lot of people don't. Mm-hmm. And so I knew I had to start educating men right from the start. The second thing he said to me was a profound gift. And he said to me, if you want to know what abuse is, I'll tell you what abuse is. And he proceeded to tell me about his family story, where he was brutalized by his family. Oh. His mother would take sewing needles and drive them through his fingertips if he stole money, and so on and so forth. And so I understood that these men, even though they are abusing their families, they also have their own trauma histories. And so I started to look at the literature, and what I found was that, in fact, connected to that trauma is this thing called shame. And if you have trauma, you have shame. They're interconnected. And so I was kind of curious, how come some of the men who learn the tools and learn them well, and you expect to do better, don't do better? And it's the reason is because they haven't dealt with their own trauma histories. And so when they get into shame, all they can do is fight for survival. So for instance, if you're a child growing up in a home where your parents are very harsh, they don't give you support. Every time you do something well, they bring you down. If you got an A-, why wasn't it an A+? They don't have time to support you, come to your sporting events, school events. You start to think there's something wrong with me. And so you carry that with you. And so in a relationship, an adult intimate relationship, your partner either wittingly or unwittingly gives you a piece of criticism, and will you go right to that shame piece? She's telling me I'm a piece of crap. And when you go to that shame piece, it's like the reaction is like you're killing an ant with a bazooka.
It's magnified.
That's how strong it is. And all you can do at that point, you can't access your tools. All you can do is fight for survival. What do? So you push back. You fight back. And oftentimes you're discarding the tools and you're doing the very same things that you were doing before you learned. So back in about 25 years ago, I started introducing trauma theory, trauma work, and shame work together. And it's been just an amazing thing to see these men disconnect their shame issues from their traumas and really move forward through that.
Daryl Hanusa, I'm wondering, does a group therapy setting make a difference in the case of these abusers? What does being around others who have this behavior, what impact does that make?
Well, I tell you what, it is just a phenomenon to behold. nothing comes close to the group process. I mean, a lot of men say to me, I don't want to do groups. I don't want to be in a group with any other people. I just want to work with you individually. And I do my best to convince them that that's a mistake. Sometimes it doesn't work, and I do some individual work, but mostly it's the group. What happens in the group is just amazing. They support one another. They work together at teams. Outside of the group session, they have buddy contacts where they talk to one another. They practice the tools. I've got groups of men who have been together for years. Mm. They do what's called an alumni group after the groups are over. They keep talking to one another, keep connecting. They have impromptu meetings. And they it's just amazing how they learn how to build trust. They learn how to promote safety among one another, which is you can do it with other men that you didn't know to start with. You can certainly do it with your family. And so the group process is just very, very powerful. I really believe in it 100%.
And clinical social worker Daryl Hanusa with us, senior lecturer at UW-Madison School of Social Work. Where are you on the path of healing from interpersonal violence? 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're focusing in on domestic violence and what counseling looks like for perpetrators, for the people who abuse a loved one. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In recent years, the Me Too movement and Time's Up, they have brought attention to and certainly more awareness to interpersonal violence. But what are outcomes like when the abuser reaches out for help or wants to stop? Be part of this hour, 800-642-1234. We have clinical social worker Daryl Hanusa, who specialized in the area of domestic violence with both perpetrators and survivors of violence since 1980. Max is joining us from Chicago. Hi, Max. What are your insights?
Hi, good morning. This is a great resource that we have this morning on this complex subject. I had a question. In a comment, what do we do with the harder cases where we find mixed motivations? For example, where there's a divorce and maybe there's custody of children at stake, where we don't find pattern abuse and it often involves provocation. And those seem to me to be difficult cases when, and I'm involved also in with the in public policy down in where I live, and we're looking at diversion programs to keep cases out of the criminal justice system. And I was wondering how that meets up with your trauma theory, which I think is very interesting.
Max, thank you. Daryl.
Well, I also do a lot of work with diversion programs, and they're wonderful because they allow perpetrators of violence a way to get the help they need in exchange for having their record not have a criminal record on file. So I believe a lot of work it needs to get done. And oftentimes when I'm working with men who come to see me, there doesn't seem to be a pattern of physical violence. But when you get underneath that and you really understand the whole continuum of abuse, there are often patterns of psychological abuse. Now, those can go both ways, and men often talk to me about the fact that their partners do the same to them, but that's not my concern at that point. What I say to the men that I work with, if it happened one or happened 100 times, my job is to help you know how to handle that critical moment when your partner is being antagonistic, and I do not believe in the concept of provocation, by the way. I believe that people can be antagonistic, but once there's that critical moment where he or she is being antagonistic, because we see domestic violence in same-sex relationships as well, you then have a responsibility about how to handle your behavior in a way that does not make your behavior the focus of negative attention. So even though there may not be a clear pattern, a history of a pattern abuse, there's oftentimes abusive behavior, lower level, if you want to call it that, but I'm even remiss to call it that because I don't want to define for that victim what his or her subjective experience of abuse is. Again, what I say to them is, look, you can't control somebody else. If that person is being antagonistic and saying hurtful things or doing hurtful things, I want you to be in a position where you can be at your best when they're at their worst. I want you to be in a position where you don't make your behavior the focus of negative attention. Because anytime your method trumps your message, you will lose every time.
Hmm. You know, you teach some ways, some alternatives in the heat of the moment. What are some of those coping strategies?
Yeah, there are 12 different communication conflict resolution skills that we teach. The very end point is taking a time out. And once you learn the tools, how to give critical feedback, how to receive critical feedback, how to use empathic listening, how to do an FU. In this case, it stands for fessing up when you've made a mistake. You plug in all the tools that you've learned. And if the situation still is not de-escalating for you, not for the other person, for you, then the end point is to take a timeout, which means leaving for a brief period of time. It doesn't mean storming out and not telling the person where you're going. It means saying something like, I'm really angry about this right now. And that's step one. Step two, I'm going to take a timeout. Step three is critical. I'm going to go for a walk to the store. I'll be back in a half an hour. And if you'd like to try this again when I get back, I'd be willing to talk with you. So there's 12 different tools that we use in concert, alone or in concert, that gives these men the technology to know how to respond differently. And that's huge because they haven't learned that. As I said earlier, they don't know how to respond other than walking out or showing their fists. So they need to learn the technology. They need to be emotionally literate and have the social skills to respond.
Max in Chicago, I'm just wondering, what diversion strategies, what diversion tactics have you been working on or that seem to work?
Well, we're actually at the stage where we're planning it, and we've got a pretty much a blank slate here. So we're trying to go about it, and we really haven't had it yet. So I'm taking a lot of notes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I can just offer you that. Go ahead.
Program. We're planning now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dane County, the county I live here in Madison, has a wonderful diversion program, and I think it would be a good idea for you to check with our district attorney's office. The diversion program runs through the DA's office, and they probably can be really a wonderful resource for you.
Max, thank you. Mary is with us now from Pewaukee. Hi, Mary. What would you like to say?
Hi. I'm very glad to have this topic this morning. I've been thinking a lot lately about the fact that I think there's a problem with men not being able to identify what is domestic abuse. And I think there needs to be a greater education of males, maybe starting when they're in high school and when they're starting to date, and so they learn what coercive control is and what it means for isolation from family and friends. I personally know four cases. Two are young married men, where the new bride has succeeded in alienating the son from the mother. And in the one case, it's my friend, and she never got to know her granddaughter. The alienation was that successful. She would hang a birthday gift on the doorknob of the house and never knew if the granddaughter got it. And she died with that son not even coming to the funeral. It's very tragic. And in another case, same thing happened with the young couple. They didn't have children, eventually divorced, and the son reunited with his mother and family. That had a good outcome. In another case, a couple married 50 years, and to this day, it's still a mystery to him as to why his wife won't participate in any social connections with his side of the family. His religious wife, who's been a good mother, and he just can't understand it. He's never attended a high school reunion. She doesn't think that they should have, and so forth. So
Mary, thank you for sharing these experiences. Daryl, any insights?
Well, Mary, I agree with you entirely that there needs to be a lot more education so people understand the full spectrum of what relationship abuse is all about. I'm part of a subcommittee called the Abuser Treatment and Monitoring Subcommittee, which is part of the Dane County Task Force. And a couple years ago, we tried to implement an ad campaign educating people, and we connected with United Way as our contact where the people could call in and talk about services that are available. Because once people get into the court system, once they're arrested, it really changes the dynamic. And what we know is that most abuse goes undetected and doesn't get into the court system. So there's a whole lot of abuse out there, Mary, where people don't know what it is and they suffer accordingly, and children suffer as well. And so we were trying to get this ad campaign going. Unfortunately, advertising is very, very expensive, and we couldn't come up with the funding and supporters to get it off the ground. But that is really what you're saying is really true. I wonder if I could circle back to one thing I talked about earlier. I know we're getting short on time.
No, that's
here,
okay.
But
please do.
One of the things that I talked about with men's trauma and how we connect it to shame is really helping them deconstruct their own pain. And so one of the things that's unique to our program is I have men write poetry. They have to describe their trauma in the form of a poem. And there's a whole technology out there about the importance of psychological writing and journaling and so on and so forth. So I have them write poems, and I'd like to share a poem with you, if I may. This is from a man who was in the program. I won't identify him, of course. But the name of this poem is called Reflections of Dad. Now, this comes after he's been in treatment for about 7 months. And it gives you some idea what these guys are capable of. They all, of course, swear that they can't write poems, but they do a very wonderful job.
And you said this is Reflections of Dad?
Reflections of Dad is the name of the poem.
Yeah.
The car door slams, chills run through my body. He's home, he's been drinking. I must take care of my family. Be still, be quiet, and listen. The yelling, the screaming, the crying. The beating begins, and the night never ends. The hatred and fear fill my bones as I call my brother on our walkie-talkie phones. Are you okay, I ask. He whispers, I'm fine. And I know in my heart I must help my mom. As I open the door, I see tears rolling down her face. He just keeps hitting her. Isn't there any safe place? I run down the stairs and jump on his back. I start hitting him and yelling, please, Dad, please stop. This is the man I never wanted to be as I look back to my father and all the hateful memories. But it's not over yet as I look in the mirror and all I can see is reflections of Dad staring at me. It scares me why I couldn't see how this is the man I've turned out to be. Each day is a struggle to turn my life around. And soon my home will be that safe ground. With hope and time, love and peace, next time I look, it will be my own reflections I see.
Oh, wow. That's really powerful.
Yes. And each one is powerful in its own way. And I have literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of poems that men have written over the years that just tear your heart out.
Do you know, I mean, you talked about alumni of your program and certainly the issue of underreporting abuse, but do you know your success rate for your program or any insights there?
Yeah, so I get asked that question a lot, you know,
yeah.
How successful is your program? And I always answer, well, what do you mean by success? And they say, well, do men stop being abusive? And they say, well, what do you mean by abusive? And they say, well, do they stop hitting? And they can say almost with a great deal of certainty, after men go through our program, hardly ever do we hear that men are hitting anymore. However, psychological abuse is a little bit different. It's a little slippery and it's harder to detect. And even women who are victims don't necessarily define emotional abuse as domestic violence. What we hear from the women that we follow as much as we can up to 4 years after the man has started treatment, somewhere around close to 80% say that they're no longer afraid of their partner. So that's the basic indicator that we really look at. Are you any less afraid of your partner than the day he entered treatment? And this is a combination of women who are still in the relationship and women who are left, but they have children with their former partner, so they still have contact. So I think we're headed in the right direction. There's this question out there, you know, in nationally and internationally, does BIP, better intervention programs, do they work? And the short answer is this. The most comprehensive study to date done by Ed Gontoff shows 50% reduction in violence versus non-completers based on partners' report. And I think the people we really have to ask aren't the batters themselves, but the partners, the victims, the ex-victims of the men whose partners have gone through treatment, because they're the ones that are going to give us the most honest answer.
The survivor story, yeah. Clinical social worker Daryl Hanusa with us, focusing on treatment for family violence. Have you called the Domestic Violence Crisis Helpline in the pandemic? Did you find help? Have you been supporting a friend or a loved one in crisis? What have you said or done? What were the effects? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Daryl Hanusa on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Clinical social worker Daryl Hanusa is with the Midwest Center for Human Services in Madison. And we're looking more closely at treatment for abusers and specifically the alternatives and treatment for abusive men. It's about a one-year program through his center as he talked about eliminating violence and a program he's worked on since 1989. Daryl is with us for 10 more minutes. Ellen is joining us from Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Ellen.
Hi there, Kate.
Good morning.
Thank you. Daryl, I want to give you the biggest thank you that I can possibly think of, because I saw the difference that your work with a couple that I know, with him in particular, with the husband. The wife was my cousin. And we didn't know half of what was going on. But it was him that shared it with the family after her death. I don't know if proud is the word or not, but he was proud of what he had learned from you, what you had made him see. And it made a wonderful difference in their lives and the lives of his sons and the life of her son and of three grandsons that they had between them. And no, there were more, actually five, I guess, total. But anyway, it was marvelous. So thank you so much.
Oh, the ripple effect. Ellen, thank you for sharing that, Daryl.
Thank you, Ellen. I know who you're talking about, and it was he really did some remarkable work in the program. Absolutely.
Let's bring in Jim now in Newport Township, Illinois. Jim, what would you like to share?
Yes, a very informative show and very worthwhile. I've heard the statistic that at least 85% of domestic abuse involves alcoholism. The one thing I think should be added to this show of extreme importance is that this is not the exclusive province of men, because I, for one, have experienced it. And not only can women get aggressive and definitely get into domestic violence, but alcoholism is involved. In addition to that, they will steal from their partner. They will even shoplift to support their habit. And I think this definitely should be added to this show.
Yeah, Jim, thank you so much. Being under the influence, Daryl, what impact can that have?
Well, so we know that alcohol doesn't cause people to be violent. But we do know that alcohol, when it's involved, usually makes the injuries produced even worse, and it's sustained over a period of time. We also know that when people who have troublesome use sober up, they don't necessarily stop their violence. So there's a co-relationship, but it's not causative. But I agree with Jim. We cannot say that domestic violence is the purview only of men. I've worked with a lot of men who have been on the receiving end of violence at the hands of their partners, and so I would agree with them that we can't just say that it's men who are abusive, because women can be. I've worked with men who have been severely physically beaten and even disfigured by severe beatings because they didn't want to fight back in a way that would injure their partner, and they suffered accordingly. It just so happens that I work mostly with men who are abusive, and the victims of those men tend to be mostly females. But Jim is exactly right. We can't just say this is just a man's issue. Anybody who makes the choice to use violence to deal with conflict or as a conflict tactic is not using a useful tool or intervention procedure at all.
Daryl, in these times, difficult times in the pandemic, what is your advice to people who find themselves in an abusive relationship?
Well, I would say reach out, break through that isolation. Don't keep it a secret. Just like shame, domestic violence can't stand up to being talked about. So find a place to talk to somebody that you trust and trust them to hear your story. There are places to get help throughout Wisconsin. We have a network of shelters and safe homes where if you are a victim, you can get help. For people who are doing the abuse, there is a network called Wisconsin Batterers Treatment Association. You can find it at www.thewbtpa.com. There's a listing of all of the certified domestic violence treatment programs in the state of Wisconsin. So I would say get help. There is help out there. You don't have to suffer both in terms of not knowing what to do when you lash out abusively or being on the receiving end and being a victim of abuse.
May I ask you, Daryl, you know, social work, being a social worker is very hard work. How do you take care of yourself through these decades?
Well, I come on shows like this and talk about it. I have a wonderful network of people that I stay connected to in who do similar work. So the Abuser Treatment and Monitoring Subcommittee, which is part of the Dane County Task Force on Domestic Violence, we are a group of treatment providers, and we huddle once a month, and we share our trials and tribulations and talk about what's working and what's not working. I am a charter member of the Wisconsin Batterers Treatment Providers Association, which is a statewide network of programs that are certified to do batter intervention. And so I stay connected with them. And within my clinic, Midwest Center for Human Services, I just have this group of people who are just wonderful and very supportive. And at any particular point, if we have questions, we reach out to one another and stay connected in that way. And I keep myself busy. I work in my lawn. I love to read. I'm fluent in Spanish, so I keep practicing Spanish every day and meet with my tutor once a week. And I do therapy in Spanish as well. So I keep myself busy, and that helps me deal with the trauma and pain that I collect in doing the work that I do.
And quickly, as we wrap up here, where do you see hope in this work?
Well, I think that, this still is a pretty new experiment, you know, trying to help people learn to use nonviolent tactics. And my hope is that we are back going upstream some and reaching younger people and getting curriculum in the schools. I think it's a huge undertaking and it takes money, unfortunately. But if we can put curricula in schools, the Teens and Tempers program, for instance, you know, teaching problem solving that's non-abusive, negotiation, collaboration, gender equality, respecting diversity, cultural humility and understanding is really, really key. And if we can get in the schools and really catch it earlier, then that's really a proactive kind of measure. So we aren't always just on the receiving end after somebody and reacting to violence once it's occurred. I think we can, do some preliminary work on that. So that's my hope.
Daryl, thank you for joining us.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for having me this morning. It was delightful.
Daryl Hanusa, clinical social worker at the Midwest Center for Human Services. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is 800-799-SAFE. That's 800-799-7233. You can find a link to resources as well at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.